President Obama has nominated D.C. Circuit Court Judge Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court. Republicans in the Senate say they won't even consider the nomination. Strap in. It's Politics Day on River to River. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. I'm joined today by political analysts Tim Hagel and Dave Anderson. We'll talk about the political impact of the Supreme Court nomination. We'll also dive into the results of yesterday's primaries, showing big wins for Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, John Kasich, and leading Marco Rubio to bow out of the race. Join our conversation after this news from NPR. Good afternoon. It's a Politics Day edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer, and we have a lot to cover today. President Obama just this morning nominated D.C. Circuit Court Judge Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court. The results from Super Tuesday number two are in, solidifying Hillary Clinton's lead over Bernie Sanders, showing big wins for Donald Trump and John Kasich in Ohio, and after losing in his home state, Marco Rubio drops out of the race. We're going to talk about Tuesday's primary results in a bit, but let's start with the big news of the Supreme Court nomination. Here's President Obama speaking this morning from the Rose Garden.
To suggest that someone as qualified and respected as Merrick Garland doesn't even deserve a hearing, let alone an up or down vote, to join an institution as important as our Supreme Court, when two-thirds of Americans believe otherwise, that would be unprecedented. To suggest that someone who has served his country with honor and dignity, with a distinguished track record of delivering justice for the American people, might be treated, as one Republican leader stated, as a political piñata, that can't be right.
He went on to say that not holding a hearing and an up or down vote would be an abdication of the Senate's constitutional duty.
It will mean everything is subject to the most partisan of politics, everything. It will provoke an endless cycle of more tit for tat and make it increasingly possible for any president, Democrat or Republican, to carry out their constitutional function. The reputation of the Supreme Court will inevitably suffer. Faith in our justice system will inevitably suffer. And our democracy will ultimately suffer as well.
And that resistance the president is referencing, of course, is from the Senate Republicans. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, in response to the president's speech this morning, said he will not consider the nomination of Merrick Garland. Well, the Senate, rather, will not consider the nomination to the Supreme Court. He also said the president is politicizing the nomination process for the purpose of the election. And Senator Grassley said that nowhere in the Constitution does it describe how the Senate should either provide its consent or withhold its consent. So, Tim, let's start with you. How do you interpret this reading of the Constitution that Senator Grassley's brought up?
Well, all that the Constitution says is with the president can nominate somebody for the Supreme Court and, of course, other lower federal courts as well with the advice and consent of the Senate. And so we've had a variety of ways that the Senate has approached that duty over the years. Depending on whether it's a Supreme Court nomination or a Court of Appeals nomination, they can always just not hold hearings. They can hold hearings and not have a vote. They can hold hearings and have a vote and reject or confirm. So there are a variety of different ways. But, of course, because this is an election year and because it's an important election year, although when isn't an important election year, but given the stakes this time that the Republicans seem to be, at least right for now, seem to be willing to say, we're just not going to move forward on this.
Mm-hmm. Let's backtrack a little bit and talk about who Garland is, because, you know, we've talked about on the show before, a lot of people thought Jane Kelly from Iowa would be the nominee to the Supreme Court. She was being vetted by the White House, but now Circuit Court Judge Merrick Garland's in the mix. Who is he? What do we know about him?
Well, he had initially been at least rumors were, that he was on the short list back in 2010 when Justice Stevens stepped down, and that was the spot that eventually went to Kagan, Justice Kagan. And he's basically somebody who's 63 years old. He had grown up in Illinois, went to Harvard, Harvard Law School, had clerked for a number of lower court justices, and then Justice Brennan on the Supreme Court, had worked in the Carter administration, Clinton administration, and had done investigation, as the prior news report indicated, on the Oklahoma City bombing, and has basically seen as kind of a moderate-type justice. Now, he'll still vote with liberals if he gets onto the court, kind of along the lines of Justice Breyer, but certainly somebody who would be less objectionable in other years to Republicans than maybe some of the other nominees that Obama could have chosen.
I'm talking with Tim Hagel this hour. He's an associate professor of politics at the University of Iowa. And joining us from our Ames studio is Dave Anderson, assistant professor of politics at Iowa State University. Hi, Dave.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And what was your reaction this morning? Were you surprised by the president's choice?
Not really. I think Merrick Garland is a really smart choice. He's very non-controversial. He has great credentials. He is not a liberal lion. So I think Obama made a very smart appointment where it puts a lot of pressure on Republicans in the Senate to at least vet the candidate.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit more about that pressure that you anticipate.
Well, I think the Republicans in the Senate right now are putting themselves in a very difficult position because, as Tim said, this is rather unprecedented. The idea that in a final year of a presidential term, the president shouldn't make a Supreme Court appointment kind of creates a lot of constitutional questions, because if the president can't make the appointment in his final year of his term, well, he only has 3 years then. And if we're going to use this logic, maybe we can extend it and say that the Senate shouldn't have confirmation powers in the final year before they're up for election. And of course, a third of the Senate is up every 2 years. So suddenly, we're starting to whittle away at when we can make Supreme Court appointments, and that's really dicey. It's hard to run a country if we can't appoint people into prominent offices.
Sure. And, you know, more on long-term implications of what happens with this, you have the Democrats entertaining the idea of abolishing filibuster rules for Supreme Court nominations. They're also considering the option of dumping the 60-vote threshold still needed to confirm nominees to the court. Do you think that the Supreme Court filibuster could ever die?
Yes, absolutely. I think over the last 20 years, what we've seen is that the Senate has become more and more dysfunctional, and that these 60-vote thresholds are preventing them from getting anything done. And inevitably, if this continues, we're going to see a time when finally the parties just decide they have to do away with it just to get normal business done. Congress has become so dysfunctional and so unable to even discuss legislation or discuss appointments that something has to be done at some point.
Hmm. Do you agree with that, Tim? Do you think that would happen anytime soon, or is this far into the future?
Well, a couple of things, I guess, on that. As far as the specific question of whether they would ever get rid of the filibuster as far as Supreme Court nominees are concerned, it's possible. And my guess is that it could happen if the Democrats retake control of the Senate in the 2016 election, so starting in 2017. And, of course, if the Republicans are in the minority, they'll do the same thing that the Democrats did when they were in the minority, which is to try to block them using the filibuster. And if they get rid of that rule, the nuclear option, as we've called it before, which they did for all lower court nominations, that wouldn't surprise me particularly. As far as the idea that the president, that the Senate maybe shouldn't be able to do its job when they're up for reelection, that's a little bit different, because we've got a situation where the president has one part of the process, the nomination part, the Senate has the confirmation part. And even the justices realized many years ago that they didn't like to come up in presidential years because it would influence a presidential election. And so maybe it hasn't happened previously specifically, but we have, of course, heard, as the clips, Republicans like to show the clips of Biden indicating that, you know, the president shouldn't nominate anybody in presidential year, and Schumer saying the same thing. So it's not, maybe it hasn't happened before, but people have certainly considered it before. And like I said, the justices themselves have recognized that they don't want to retire, at least in a presidential year, because it all of a sudden becomes part of the presidential election process.
We're talking this hour about President Obama's nomination of Judge Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court. Does this nomination change your opinion of whether there should be a Senate hearing? We want to hear from you this hour. Do you have questions about the nomination process? You can join our conversation by giving us a call at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. You can message us on Facebook or email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Again, the number to call is 866-780-9100. And Grant wants to join the conversation from Ankeny. Hello, Grant. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
What's your question?
My question is for the panel, and I want to know if there was any indication in the nominee's record about how he might vote if the Citizens United case comes up.
Okay, Grant, you're breaking up a little bit there, but I think Grant's question was, you know, is there any indication of how Garland might vote in a case about Citizens United?
Well, I haven't seen anything yet on that particular issue. The only one that I saw people talking about today had to do with gun rights, that apparently he's in favor of gun control, which, of course, is not going to make Republicans happy, will make Democrats happy. I guess we'd have to see. I think it's probably going to be one of those things where most justices or judges will often accept the law, the case as it is, that they wouldn't necessarily want to overturn it, but they'll look for other ways to deal with that particular issue, whether it's a free speech issue like Citizens United and how that fits into campaign spending and things of that nature, so they can find other ways to maybe undercut the law in the particular case without actually overturning it. And that would be my best guess for Garland, given his perceived more moderate stance.
Mm-hmm. And does the fact – some people are talking about the fact that Garland is a little bit older. He's 63 years old, I believe. Does that make him more of a compromise nominee, that he wouldn't be in the court for, you know, 40, 50 years?
Yeah. Let me kind of run through a couple of things here real quick that people have been thinking about, or at least I've been thinking about. One way to look at Garland is that because Obama could have picked somebody that would be even harder – for the Senate Republicans to refuse because of identity politics or demographics or what have you, that in that sense it can make the Senate Republicans more steadfast in their position to not have a hearing for him and so forth. And as a result, it becomes an issue throughout the campaign, which may work to the Democrats' advantage. So that's one way of looking at it. On the other hand, later in the campaign, if Hillary Clinton's the nominee, and regardless of who the Republican nominee is, if it looks like Clinton's going to win and possibly the Republicans are going to lose control of the Senate, then Garland, being perceived again as a moderate, maybe not on all issues, but just overall, and a little bit older, that he could spend 20 years on the court, but it might not be 30 or 40 as some other younger nominees could, that he might be the choice that the Republicans would say, well, it could be somebody that's even more ideologically to the left that they would like even less. And so it may be that the Republicans will change their mind and actually have hearings and a vote before the end of the summer. Plus, the other thing to keep in mind on this is that at a certain point, if Clinton looks like she's going to be the president, she might want to be able to nominate somebody quickly to the Supreme Court. That would be a feather in her cap, so to speak. And so you get kind of a little infighting potentially among Democrats on that point.
I mentioned at the beginning of the hour that Senator Grassley said nowhere in the Constitution does it say we need to nominate whoever the president puts forward. He, along with other Republicans in the Senate, have kind of gone back and forth on how, you know, they would approach this. But so far, it looks like they will not be considering the president's nominee. And we have a question about that from Mike in Des Moines. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Great, thanks. Interesting topic. And I had a question for the panelists about, as Iowans, Senator Grassley, of course, plays a very unique role in this process. He's spoken about this a few times and has come across a little flustered, I think, at times. He has a reelection bid coming up, and it looks like that reelection is no longer just a cakewalk for him. It's something that may be a tough fight. And I'm wondering what your panelists think about the pressure that may come to bear on Senator Grassley and how they think he's going to hold up to that pressure.
All right. Thanks for your call, Mike. So, yeah, that election he's talking about is coming up soon, November 2016. Incumbent Senator Grassley may face a little competition. What do you think? Dave, you want to approach that first?
Sure. Well, I think it certainly could be a factor in the upcoming year. If this election with Chuck Grassley becomes a very close one, a very contested one, he may face pressure to change his stance, especially if the Supreme Court nomination becomes an issue in Iowa. I think the bigger issue is the overall presidential and Senate election nationwide. The Republican Party is defending 24 seats. The Democratic Party is only defending 10 this year. And the expectation is that the Republican Party will likely lose some seats in the Senate. And they have to start looking at this, especially as we get closer to November. If it looks likely that Hillary Clinton's going to win the presidency, and it looks likely that the Democratic Party may emerge with a majority in the Senate, the Republican Party has to start looking, as Tim was saying, about maybe confirming or at least holding hearings on Garland or facing a much more liberal and a much younger appointment from Hillary Clinton. And if that pressure grows, if that scenario kind of starts playing out, we really may see Chuck Grassley and a bunch of the Republicans in the Senate changing their mind and suddenly becoming more open to holding hearings.
If we want to kind of, you know, predict the future and see who he might be up against, a lot of people are looking to former Iowa Lieutenant Governor and State Ag Secretary Patty Judge. She's expected to announce her challenge this weekend to Grassley. And some say she would be a formidable challenger. What do you think about that, Tim? Do you expect that would be quite a challenge?
Well, that's the perceived expectation, although from what I've seen that not everybody for the Democrats necessarily agrees with that, partly because of concern that maybe it's the party elders that are determining this rather than the people. So you have to be careful about how that's perceived. But certainly she has won, as people have indicated, a couple of statewide races on her own for ag secretary and also as part of the Culver administration. The one winning election, of course, lost the second time around. But at least that gives her much higher name recognition than some of the other people that are interested in running against Senator Grassley. And that's going to help. But how much it's actually going to hurt Grassley, it's hard to say at this point. That we do like our incumbents here in Iowa, regardless of the party. And Grassley, of course, is usually considered one of the most favored politicians in the state and has a good organization. So I think it would be difficult for anybody. Now, the turnout's going to be key, and we'll have to see what happens with that. And for different reasons, both Democrats and Republicans may be facing challenges in terms of getting their people turned out. But even if Iowa ends up going for the Democratic nominee in the presidential race, that might not necessarily hurt Grassley because he did manage to win re-election in 1992 when Clinton was elected, Bill Clinton was elected.
Is there any historical precedent that we can look to see, you know, how voter turnout is impacted by possible or actual U.S. Supreme Court vacancies? How much does that motivate people to get out and vote?
You know, given that it rarely happens where we have a vacancy in the Supreme Court, it's probably not going to motivate it too much. Now, I think it'll probably be a talking point, undoubtedly, for both the left and the right. We've heard it from both parties already about this because it is critical that right now we had with just when Justice Scalia was still on the court before he died, it was basically a 5-4 majority for the conservatives, although Kennedy was usually seen as fairly moderate when often joined the liberal bloc. And so with Scalia gone, it's kind of a 4-4 now with, again, Kennedy kind of iffy. So if all of a sudden you get a liberal justice on the court, that's going to make the right very unhappy, the left very happy. So it is critical in that sense, a number of issues that are coming up. And I think that for the Democrats, it actually works out well because it gives them a way to tie together a number of issues that would normally be just sort of little things appealing to small groups here and there. Important ones, not to say the least, but still not something that would be kind of a unifying theme, where this time they can kind of do it that way, especially, again, if the Republicans refuse to hold hearings or vote on the nominee.
Mm-hmm. Dave, what do you think about, you know, not so much voter turnout, but how the voter perceives, you know, a 4-4 case? One of these cases coming down 4-4. Some of the cases they're looking at involve access to abortion clinics, access to birth control, Obama's authority on immigration. When the public sees these and they could possibly come down 4-4, is there any sort of political negative impact to that?
Well, I think the political impact is that the issue is raised in the public awareness and it becomes a campaign point, something that the candidates will talk about. And I think this certainly could become a big issue in the presidential campaign cycle. Certain presidential candidates, like I think Ted Cruz, can really effectively use this to increase his base of support by arguing that he wants to appoint a strong constitutional conservative, someone who really aligns with his beliefs, and that can motivate his voters. I'm not sure that someone like Donald Trump is going to be able to capitalize on this as much. Hillary Clinton probably can capitalize to a degree, but I think the bigger issue is that this is going to open the avenue to raise different issues during this election cycle.
I'd like to get to another call before the break. Tim is calling from Ames. Hi, Tim.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, thanks for calling in. So what are your thoughts as you're listening to the discussion?
Well, I'm certainly not surprised that the Republicans refuse to even consider holding hearings or even, for that matter, even meeting with the nominee. I mean, I don't think Judge Scalia had passed for more than 24 hours before Mitch McConnell made the statement that the Republicans weren't going to hold hearings. And I think it just basically gets back to their Republican obstructionism since day one of the Obama administration. I mean, it's worth remembering that there are a significant portion of Republicans, just regular Republicans, not necessarily Tea Party people, who don't even think President Obama was born in the United States. So, you know, when you have some party that is just so oppositional that they don't even concede the citizenship of the president, it's hardly surprising that they engage in this sort of behavior.
All right. Thanks for your call, Tim. Tim, do you want to respond to that obstructionism?
Yeah, and that's not entirely surprising, although, of course, Republicans will quickly point to the fact that during the George W. Bush administration, that when the Senate Democrats when the Democrats controlled the Senate, that they managed to keep a lot of George W. Bush's nominees to the courts of appeals sort of in limbo, I guess is the way to phrase it. I don't know if they had actually hearings on some of these folks, but they didn't come up for a vote. There were a couple of people, Miguel Estrada, Janice Rogers Brown, and a few others. Some of them eventually got on because they worked out a deal among the senators, a bipartisan deal, but some others like Estrada never did make it onto the court. Part of the reason for that, the speculation is that there was a concern among the Democrats that some of these folks, if they got onto the courts of appeals, that they would perhaps be moved up to the Supreme Court if a vacancy occurred, and they didn't want to have that happen, and so they blocked them even from the Court of Appeals. So it's not something that's totally hasn't happened before, shall we say.
All right. Well, Tim and Dave, stay with us. Tim Hagel is an associate professor of politics at the University of Iowa. Dave Anderson is an assistant professor of politics at Iowa State University. And coming up in just a few minutes, we're going to be talking about Super Tuesday number 2. The results are in. What is your reaction to yesterday's primaries? And do you have any questions on the delegate process? You can join our conversation by giving us a call at 866-780-9100. Again, that's 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, message us on Facebook, or email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Thanks for joining us. This is River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. Glad you're joining us for this Politics Day discussion on River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury, in for Ben Kiefer. I'm joined today by political analyst Dave Anderson of Iowa State University and Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. In the first half, we talked about the president's nomination of D.C. Circuit Court Judge Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court. If you missed that, you can check that later online. It'll be posted at iowapublicradio.org. Search for River to River. And for the rest of the hour, we're going to be talking about the results from yesterday's primaries, results that solidified Hillary Clinton's lead over Bernie Sanders, John Kasich's win in Ohio, other wins to Donald Trump in the other states. And after losing in his home state, Marco Rubio has dropped out of the race. We want to hear about your reaction to yesterday's primaries. Do you have any questions on the delegate process? You can join our conversation by calling 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Or we have a little conversation started on our Facebook page. You can send us a message there. And I want to read a couple comments from our Facebook page. Karen says, without Marco Rubio, I feel we no longer have a decent choice. I'm feeling really hopeless about the shape of this country. Seth says that he's feeling the heartburn. a little pun there from Seth. And Patrick says disappointment. So, again, we want to hear your reaction. Call us at 866-780-9100. So the primaries in five states yesterday, Ohio, Florida, Illinois, Missouri, and North Carolina. I want to get first your reactions, Tim and Dave. Were you surprised by the results? Dave, do you want to go ahead and start us off?
I was a little surprised just in the strength of both the Trump victory and the Clinton victory. I think both the frontrunners did very well yesterday and solidified their status as clear frontrunners for their party nominations. And I think this kind of bodes a little ill for both parties in that there are some troubles ahead for both parties.
Mm. And when you say trouble ahead, can you expand on that?
Well, of course, everybody, I think, right now is wondering whether Donald Trump will get the necessary delegate count to secure the nomination before the convention, or whether the Republican Party is going to go into a contested convention. And I'm sure we'll talk more about that. But on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton is kind of stretching out into a pretty formidable lead. It's becoming very difficult to imagine a scenario where Bernie Sanders remains competitive or could secure the nomination himself. And yet Bernie Sanders is showing no signs of bringing some reconciliation to the party. And I think people are starting to wonder what's it going to take to bring the Democratic Party together as well.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Trump and the delegates he needs. To claim the Republicans' party nomination, he needs the vote of 1,237 specifically delegates. And right now he's leading in the count with 661. Cruz has 406 and Kasich has 142. So Trump's about halfway to the number of delegates he needs to be the automatic nominee. Looking at the state primaries still to come, do you think he'll get there, Tim?
You know, it's really hard to say. We've still got a situation, even with Rubio out of the race, where Kasich is in. He hasn't been strong, but a number of people are suggesting that, okay, he's won Ohio. He doesn't really have a path. And it, certainly individually Kasich doesn't have a path to get to the 1237. But what he can do is perhaps keep votes away from Cruz, who then can't beat Donald Trump. I don't know that necessarily the Kasich and Cruz, that their backers are that compatible necessarily. But the idea is if you are looking to somebody to stop Donald Trump and the Republican Party, regardless of whether you think Cruz is great or Kasich is great or not, that those are your choices to stop Trump. And so with both of them in the race, it's very difficult to do so. And that's one of the reasons that Cruz over the last week or so has been suggesting, without often necessarily naming Kasich and Rubio, that they should get out of the race. Well, now Rubio is out, but Kasich is still in. And we've sort of seen in looking at the results last night where there were a couple of instances where, you know, two of the candidates would take votes away from a third one. Now, Kasich managed to win Ohio in part because Rubio told his backers to go ahead and vote for Kasich, his Ohio backers to vote for Kasich. Kasich didn't return the favor, and neither did Cruz in Florida. And whether Rubio would have won Florida if the people had voted strategically is hard to say. But we can see in a couple of other states like Missouri, which is still razor thin, very, very tiny margin between those two, that maybe it would have made a difference. So we just kind of have to wait and see at this point. But certainly Kasich has no chance for getting the delegates before the convention, a contested convention. Cruz is an outside chance, but probably not with Kasich in the race.
Let's take a listen to some comments Cruz made in a speech last night.
Starting tomorrow morning, every Republican has a clear choice. Only two campaigns have a plausible path to the nomination, ours and Donald Trump's. Nobody else has any mathematical possibility whatsoever. Only one campaign has beaten Donald Trump over and over and over again.
Dave, what do you think about that? As Tim just mentioned, and as we heard from Cruz, Kasich, you know, he would actually need more than 100% of the remaining delegates. So, you know, unless we're going to see a contested convention, he's out of the race. Do you think we can say with certainty that it's going to be a Cruz-Trump, you know, competition to the nomination?
No, I don't think so, because John Kasich has been saying for a very long time that he has a path to the nomination, but his path is through a contested convention. So his goal is not to win all the remaining primaries and to secure enough delegates before the convention. His entire goal here has always been to win Ohio and then to deny Trump and Cruz a majority of delegates before the convention. John Kasich believes that once he gets to the convention, he can appeal to the moderates, the establishment Republicans who were at the convention, and he can secure the nomination away from Trump and Cruz, regardless of how many states they win or how many delegates they have.
Do you think he has the backing of that Republican establishment?
I think now that Marco Rubio has dropped out, I think the establishment is going to quickly do a pivot to him because we all know that Donald Trump does not have strong backing from the Republican establishment, but neither does Ted Cruz. They have recently been a little bit more conciliatory to him, but there is very little love for Ted Cruz among the Republican establishment. It would be a very bitter pill for them to have to swallow. Whereas I think a lot of people are going to say, if you're going to go through the nastiness of a contested convention, you might as well at least back somebody that you like.
Hmm.
And that's probably John Kasich.
Do you agree with that, Tim?
You know, I do. And I was trying to think of some way to go along with the bitter pill thing, that it may be a bitter pill that they could swallow. But I think that if they had to accept Trump, that would be a pill large enough to choke on or something like that. I have to work on my humor skills, I guess. But yeah, Cruz certainly hasn't been somebody that has made friends among the establishment. But the establishment is also very, by and large, is very worried about Trump. Now, it's not total that you have seen people sort of open to the possibility, and especially if somehow you see Trump sort of change his demeanor as time goes on. Now, it's hard to say if that will happen, that he certainly has been successful approaching the race as he has, and whether that continues if he gets the nomination into the general election, we'll have to wait and see. But certainly there are a lot of people that don't want to take a chance on the possibility of a Trump nomination, and so they would be willing to accept Cruz over Trump as a result.
For a contested convention, if I understand this correctly, the Republican Party could pick anyone. They don't even need to pick the people that have been in the race so far. And here's something a little bit out of left field that I want you both to comment on. Former Speaker John Boehner said that Paul Ryan should be the Republican nominee for president if the party fails to choose a candidate on the first ballot. What do you guys think of that? Dave, do you want to start us off?
Sure. Well, first, I'd want to say that the rules for how a contested convention runs are still up for debate. The rules are not officially set until the convention, so they can be changed at any time.
They change every election
yes.
cycle. Mm.
So right now, there's a lot of press going to the fact that there's Rule 40 that says that in order to be able to be nominated from the floor, you have to have won a majority of delegates in 8 different states. And this was a rule that was put in place in 2012 to prevent Ron Paul from being a possibility. And now there are questions about, well, is John Kasich going to cross that threshold? Because if not, he couldn't stand for the nomination. And of course, that would mean that Paul Ryan, for example, couldn't stand because he's not on the ballot anywhere. But that rule is likely to be changed. It's likely to go away, which creates a lot of headaches, really. And mainly, I think it's because at the very beginning, the outset of the GOP nomination battle, Donald Trump said loud and clear, I will not run as a third-party candidate unless the GOP establishment treats me unfairly. And now what is he largely saying? He's saying, listen, if I have most delegates, if I'm close to the majority, you have to give me the nomination. And if the Republican Party starts changing rules in order to dethrone him and prevent him from getting the nomination, it's a very likely scenario, I think, that he starts pursuing a third-party bid, and that destroys the Republican Party's chance of winning in November.
Hmm. Do you agree with that, Tim?
Yeah, and of course, the phrase that was running through my mind was Bull Moose Party, although Trump wouldn't form that. For those that aren't aware, this is what Teddy Roosevelt did when he didn't like the Republican nominee, formed his third party and basically gave the election to the Democrats back in the early 1900s. The Republicans have been talking about the same thing. If Trump is the nominee, if the Republican establishment manages to steal, and put little air quotes around that, the nomination from Trump, then he forms a third party. And either way, it's going to hurt the Republicans and pretty much hand the election to the Democrats, regardless of who their nominee is. Yeah, it's very difficult, and we get the question of, well, who can be nominated on the first ballot? And then you get into the weeds and start talking about, well, what about on the second ballot? Because then potentially the delegates aren't bound, at least not consistently so. They're bound in some states. They're not bound in other states. They can vote who they want, can bring somebody else in that's not even – wasn't even running. Again, back to Boehner saying that he supports Ryan. Could Ryan do it? Well, as a House member, we wouldn't expect so, but then if he's handed the nomination in that respect, then he's already there for the general. And, of course, having been a former VP nominee, that gives him a head start on anybody else that maybe would try to run from a House seat as opposed to a senator gubernatorial position or a famous business person like Trump. So there's a lot that we just don't know at this point. We have to wait and see.
If you've just tuned in, this is River to River from Iowa Public Radio. We're talking about last night's primaries. And let's hear a little bit from Trump last night. Here are some comments he made at a press conference in Florida.
The fact is, we have to bring our party together. We have to bring it together. We have something happening that actually makes the Republican Party probably the biggest political story anywhere in the world. Everybody's writing about it all over Europe. All over the world, they're talking about it. Millions of people are coming in to vote. This was an example of it today. Many, many more people. I'm looking at the polling booths. I'm looking at different polling booths all around the country where it's up. And the lines are 4, 5, 6 blocks long.
So we hear here Trump's urging unity. Is he going to get this, or could it divide the Republican Party? Tim?
Yes.
Exactly.
He's talking unity now, and that's good. He said nice things about Marco Rubio last night after Rubio had dropped out before Trump got to speak. And so in that sense, I suppose that you could see a softening towards the opposition to Trump. And Trump's certainly right that there are a lot of people that seem to be disaffected and not interested in the political process that are coming out to support Trump. But the concern that many Republicans, many conservatives still have is that he just isn't sufficiently experienced. He doesn't seem to be specific in his policy pronouncements. It's all well and good to say, as his phrase is, make America great again, but they want to know the how part of it and aren't entirely confident that Trump understands the how part of it. On the other hand, we may see, like I say, over time an improvement along those lines. And if we don't, then yes, there's going to be fractured. And I've seen a lot of conservatives already say that they're really not sure what they're going to do if it's a Clinton versus Trump. Some even suggesting they would vote for Clinton. Some saying, they'll write their own name in or something like that, or vote for some other third party candidate.
You can join our conversation. We have a few minutes left in the program. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. Wally called that number from Bradford. Wally, what's your question?
This speaks to some arithmetic that's been tossed around recently. It's been pointed out in recent days that some of the wins in primaries that have gone towards Clinton's side have taken place in states that traditionally do not go Democrat in the general election. I'm curious if anyone has any opinions, and this is probably just simple arithmetic, but there's a lot of guessing involved. Has anybody looked to see if Donald Trump's great wins, or how many of them have come in states that he really has very little chance of carrying in November?
Interesting question, Wally. Thanks for calling in. So, I mean, we're doing this on the fly. This is live radio. But we know that Donald Trump won in all primaries yesterday: Florida, Illinois, Missouri, North Carolina, and John Kasich won in Ohio. Are these states, Florida, Illinois, Missouri, North Carolina, states that usually go Republican?
Not necessarily. So I this is a really great question because this goes to the electoral map we're looking at in 2016. Most people like to think that when voters go to the polls in an election year, that we really don't know what's going to happen. And the truth is that we pretty much know how about 42 states are going to vote already. You can look at the electoral map and based upon polling, based upon party strength in the various states, how they traditionally vote, we can pretty accurately predict how about 42 states are going to vote. So we know the electoral math already. And I believe the math right now suggests that the Democratic Party looks to win 247 Electoral College votes, and the Republican Party is down closer to about 180, which means the Republican Party has a steep hill to climb already. Of course, the states that really matter in November, Florida, Ohio, North Carolina, Iowa, we happen to be one of them. These are the states that everybody's watching, and Trump is looking pretty strong in some of these states. Of course, John Kasich won Ohio, which really burnishes his credentials. But this is a really great question. Hillary Clinton has done very well in the South, in the southern states, that no Democrat has a realistic chance of winning in the general election. But she does also look strong in some of the important states, Florida. She looks good in Ohio. She does look good in places that she needs to win.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Democrat side. Let's hear a little bit from Bernie Sanders. He made these comments last night in Arizona. And just to note, the applause has been shortened.
We started this campaign at 3% in the national polls. We have come a long way in 10 months. And the reason that we have done as well as we have, the reason that we have defied all expectations, is that we are doing something very radical in American politics. We're telling the truth.
All right. And Armando from Iowa City has a question related to this. Hello, Armando.
Hi. How are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing. So what are you considering right now?
So I'm actually an organizer here in Iowa, and we have a lot of volunteers, and we actually don't support anybody specific. But some of the issues that the Sanders campaign talks about is what we do support, and there's a lot of people who do support that around the country, obviously. So my question is, we feel a lot of progressive or liberal people who or support Sanders that it's going to be between bad or no change at all, and I'm going to know what everybody thinks or if it's something that's going to hurt the Clinton campaign in the general election, because a lot of people feel that they do want change, but they don't want to support Trump at all. So I want to know what people think about that.
All right, Armando, thanks for your call. Dave, do you want to tackle that first? We know what will happen to all these Bernie Sanders supporters if Hillary gets the nomination?
That is a large open question. Bernie Sanders has, I think, defied most expectations. He's run a fantastic campaign. He is growing the Democratic Party. He's really energizing the base. The big question remaining is, can he then bring these supporters back into the Democratic Party if Hillary Clinton is the nominee? Typically, in a nomination battle, you would expect a nominee at some point to say, okay, I'm losing. I'm not likely to get the nomination. So let's just make sure that we solidify this institution of the party. But Bernie Sanders, of course, is not a long-term Democrat. He was an independent. He's always been an independent. He joined the Democratic Party for the purpose of becoming a presidential nominee. And it's an open question whether he's going to choose to bring his supporters into the Democratic fold. I think everyone's assuming he will at some point, but he's not really showing it yet. It's one of the big questions remaining on the Democratic side.
Tim, what do you think? We specifically have a lot of young voters who may have not ever been involved in a presidential election or political process until now. And, you know, you see a lot of criticism of Hillary Clinton. Do you think that they're going to end up, you know, going with whoever the Democratic Party makes the nominee, or will they just become disillusioned and kind of drop out?
Well, as Dave said, that's the open question right now. We're seeing this year in both parties as the year of the outsider. And Trump, of course, we've already talked about bringing a lot of people in, but that's true of Bernie Sanders, too. And even though He's technically been in Congress for a long time because he's just now become a Democrat officially and is seen as an outsider and is talking, as he said in that clip, telling the truth, that appeals to younger people who are maybe disillusioned or they see it's all, you know, political talk. Nobody says what they mean and that sort of thing. And if he's not the nominee, will they become so disillusioned saying, oh, we tried to make a change and it didn't happen? Or will Hillary Clinton's campaign successfully be able to reach out to those folks who haven't been supporting her and say, okay, we're going to pick up this mantle, this baton or whatever it is, analogy you want to use, that Sanders has started and carry it forward? But the danger there is that if she then pivots to the middle for the general election, that's where she may lose some of these more progressive, particularly younger people. And again, that's where turnout's going to be a key to all of this.
All right. Another great politics discussion. We'll be back next Wednesday at noon. Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Politics at the University of Iowa. Tim, thanks so much for joining us.
Welcome.
And Dave Anderson, Assistant Professor of Politics at Iowa State University. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks for having me.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production help from Jason Burns in Ames today. Thanks to everyone who called in and participated online. I'm Emily Woodbury. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.